Well, in terms of popular culture, football, if you think about the qualities of football, Americans love violence. They love rivalries. They love a stadium, screaming fans. Football has all those qualities.
Welcome to Forum, Beyond the Pages, the podcast that tells the stories behind the stories of Florida Humanities award-winning magazine. I'm Andrew Quintana. It's game on in this newest season as we speak to the writers who penned the articles in our spring 2024 sports issue of Forum. This week, Florida historian Gary R. Mormino on his story, Gridiron Glory. Many may argue that there's nothing more American than football. However, in his article for the spring issue of Forum magazine, legendary Florida historian Gary Mormino argues that there's nothing more Floridian than college football. With a personal essay from veteran journalist Bill Maxwell, the story provides a cultural history of the Sunshine State's fervor for football and the game's connection to some of its growing pains. I never took you for a football fan, to be completely honest, but I guess when you're as passionate about Florida history, you kind of have to embrace the football portion of it. Did you always want to write a story like this, or was it kind of a challenge for you to approach?
Well, fortunately for me, I had been working on a book project I've never yet published called A Social History of Modern Florida. So I have chapters on religion, immigration, violent guns, and I had a separate chapter on football and baseball. So it was a perfect setup for me.
Let's talk about the beginning of your article, because there's no better place to start than the beginning. You trace the origins of what would become American football in this game in Tallahassee played by indigenous peoples. And you do a pretty good job setting up not only the rules, but the atmosphere of it, that it's almost similar to the football we see today. I wanted to know, is there a belief that the sport really did sprout from that game? Or was that your way of showing readers that football was always in Florida's DNA?
The latter. Most people would argue that football transitioned from rugby. Nonetheless, it is a sport. It has eerie parallels to football. What's also striking about it is that the game was played at San Luis mission site, which overlooks today's Doak Campbell Stadium. So there's an eerie quality about the article.
Fast forwarding a couple hundred years, I think you do a pretty good job mapping out the slow but bubbling fandom of football in Florida when you go through the college level. How influential was collegiate football to the growth of the sport, not only across the country, but in the state?
Modern Florida football emerged rather late in both America and in Florida. There's the first intercollegiate football game is played in 1899 or 1901. That's 20, 25 years after football was introduced in the Northeast. Whereas baseball really had some Southern ties toward the origin, football was a Northeastern sport at the collegiate level, rather elitist level. And many of the early coaches in the South came from Northern schools. And there's a dramatic moment. It's 1926. The University of Alabama has finally comprised a pretty good football team, and they defeat Washington, the number one team in the nation, in the Rose Bowl. And that's considered one of those games that there's a before and after quality.
How did it start making its way down here? Because you mentioned, you know, there's early rivalries between schools that we would see today. Of course, they weren't called University of Florida, Florida State University. They went by different names. But how did that success, that wave of football, just start making its way down to the Sunshine State?
Well, in terms of popular culture, football, if you think about the qualities of football, Americans love violence. They love rivalries. They love a stadium, screaming fans. Football has all those qualities.
What does the early Florida football look like? You know, you mentioned the 20s with Alabama and Washington, how that game kind of changed. But that landscape at the time, how did it look like in Florida?
Well, some of the powerhouses, places like Stetson, played football. So the first intercollegiate game in Florida, I believe, was between Stetson and Florida Agricultural College. which is today's University of Florida, then at Lake City. And in 1904, the state legislature reorganizes higher ed. Florida State College for Women will be in the old East Florida Seminary, which is Tallahassee, and Florida Agricultural College is moved to Gainesville. That becomes the University of Florida. And in some ways, that new expectation is part of this, because we're reading about other people's successes. You have governors in Florida. Part of their campaign promises, if you'll elect me, I promise a winning football team at the University of Florida.
Of course, we can't talk about the influence of college football without mentioning some of the historic Black colleges and universities at the time as well. Chief among them, Florida Agricultural Mechanical University, also known as FAMU. Can you tell me just how influential HBCUs were to the sport growing?
It is hard to overemphasize the pride, the passion that FAMU had in the state. College football in Florida on the competitive level was pretty mediocre until the 1970s, except for one place that most Floridians didn't know about or care about. Florida Agricultural Mechanical University, FAMU, with its legendary coach, Jake Gaither. And he would send letters out. His recruiting letter was simply, "You are invited to attend Florida A&M University. It's a privilege for you to go there." And so Gaither also famously said, "I want my boys to be agile, hostile, and mobile." In some ways, the game we love today, fast, paced, etc., that was Jake Gaither's game 50 years ago.
You make it very clear that all the success these HBCUs earned came through much adversity. Beyond the limited funding and resources, segregation really impacted how players and coaches were able to play. It's something Bill talks about in his portion of the story. Mm-hmm.
On a September afternoon in 1962, I walked into Coach Bernard Irving's classroom to ask about an assignment. In addition to being our head football coach, Irving was our chemistry, biology teacher at all-black Middleton Junior High School in Crescent City, Florida. Coach, as we called him, and Thomas Colbert, our social studies teacher and special events bus driver, were poring over a map of Florida. They were deciding the best route from Crescent City to Green Cove Springs, some 50 miles away, where we would play all-black Dunbar High School that Friday night. Mr. Colbert was saying he did not know of any official sundown towns on the route, but that unofficial ones were just as dangerous. He said we should be safe if we did not have mechanical trouble that trapped us on the side of the road, making us target practice for crackers passing by. Like most black children in Crescent City, I knew about sundown towns, those notorious all-white communities that banned Negroes from being inside the city limits after dark. Mr. Colbert reassured Coach that he would bring his toolbox, tire jack, and dog-eared copy of the Green Book. But despite Mr. Colbert's reassurances, I could hear concern in his voice.
The opening to that section, it almost sounds like the opening of a heist movie, where there's this big plan where if anything goes wrong, it's, you know, life or death, which is crazy when you really think about it, because you're just going to a high school football game at the end of the day. It really visualizes the brutality of segregation in the South at the time, I think. And I was curious while I was reading that, if at the time, did you know how much of a risk or how much danger you were in just traveling across the state playing football?
Yes, we did. Our parents, the other adults in our lives back then, gave us the talk, and they made sure that we understood that there was racism out there, that there were white people who you saw every day, who would, under the cover of darkness or on a Friday night, become just the opposite and join in with other whites who hated us. Everywhere we went, we felt that we had to be very cautious because we knew that we were not wanted. We knew as children that we were the other. We knew that.
Despite the risks, though, that was posed by traveling and playing these football games, football seemed to have a really big presence in your town. How did that come to be? How did football seem to take a hold of this small rural part of Florida?
Well, you know, football then was popular everywhere, but in small black towns across the state, it was our identity. You know, winning victory was important. You know, we didn't win at very many things because we didn't have much to win at. So football was competitive, and actually it was an equalizer. You know, it was one way to actually have bragging rights, and we didn't have very many things to brag about.
Your coach has this presence throughout the story, almost like a point of order in a very chaotic period of time. What did that presence mean to you growing up?
Well, it meant a lot. I didn't grow up with my father, for example. My father was gone. So there were several other boys on our team. They didn't have dads. So Coach Irving, he was our father. And even more, he was an inspiration in that he was well-educated. He was a big guy. He played football and basketball in college. So we admired him. And even more than that, he was a real guardian. He would go to our classrooms. He would go to our teachers. He would check on our grades. He would check on our attendance.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Florida A&M University for a little bit. Can you tell me about the reputation FAMU had when you were growing up and the allure it had for college athletes who were aspiring to go play?
Yeah, well, for us, it was heaven. It was where you wanted to go. I don't know a single player, football player in Florida, and I played against many schools, and I attended three. I don't know anyone who played football, who did not want to go to FAMU. Jay Gaither was a winner. You know, he won more national championships than any other black football coach. And you had people like Willie Galamo. You had people like Bob Hayes. All of those guys went to FAMU, and they went to the pros. And so Jay Gaither sent players to pro football, and he had 32. The years he coached, he had 32 All-Americans. So he was a god, and you know, that's what you did. You put on a uniform to go to FAMU. The other schools in the state were afterthoughts.
When I finished reading your story, I had a series of what ifs jump into my mind. You know, I was thinking, you know, what if segregation didn't create all these hurdles for the team and the boys, and were able to play with the school that was just up the road? What if Bill was a little bigger and he could go to FAMU? What would that look like? Do you ever have these thoughts when you think back at that period of time? Do you ever get those what ifs?
Yeah, I get them all. I still get them. Yeah. If I had been just 15 pounds heavier, I could have gone to FAMU because they came and looked at me. Jack Gaither had the pick of the litter. So a lot of great black football players had nowhere to go. So they languished. You never saw them, never heard of them. And to me, that's the biggest thing that I regret about Jim Crow, was that it did not give a lot of very good people a chance to succeed. And I think that's regrettable. I often think of other players who would have played in college, especially our scat backs and our pass receivers, who were virtually untouchable in the secondary. But recruiters never came to see them in action. Yet, despite Jim Crow's cruel inhumanity, the leadership of Coach and the lessons we learned playing football helped many of us survive and succeed in life.
The battle to integrate the game. How did that play out?
Several Florida schools refused to play in a bowl game. University of Miami is one. Because the opposing team had a black player. This is in the 50s and 60s we're talking about. And what's happening is the northern schools, places like University of Wisconsin, Ohio State, they're coming down here and recruiting all-star, all-American players and winning. And ultimately, it's social justice, but it's also just a matter of we can't win if we don't recruit these African-American players. Most viewers would probably think, well, this happens with the Brown decision in 54. It's almost 20 years later. It's the early 70s when integration in football begins to have an effect here.
It seems like once all the racial barriers were finally lifted, the floodgates opened and football in Florida kind of flourished. Between the 1980s and 2000s, Florida teams really kind of gripped the national attention. You have the University of Miami Hurricanes of the 1980s. You have Bobby Bowden's Florida State Seminoles of the 90s. Florida teams always seemed from that point on to make a case for the best team of that era. What did that period of just unrelenting success do for the sport here at home?
Pure delirium, joy, a lot more money pouring into these programs. And something else has happened in the previous half century. Florida matters now, population-wise. Florida has moved. Florida is no longer the least populated state in the South, as it was in 1940. It's becoming a Sunbelt power. The other extraordinary thing is money. Today, you could almost look at every 50 states, and I could guess the top public state salary belongs to a football or basketball coach.
I think it's funny that you start bringing up the debate about money in collegiate sports, because you wisely end the story on that conundrum. Yes. That we find ourselves in today, where do we draw the line between this money-making industry, but the academic side as well? I mean, these are colleges at the end of the day having student athletes on the field. So where does that line get drawn?
A sports commentator about 25 years ago proclaimed famously, the answer to all questions in sports is money. We spend as much time today talking about money in sports than the sport itself. I mean, you have these extraordinary television contracts, and now you have cable contracts, and you've got booster clubs. It's insane in a lot of ways, but it's not going away either.
What do you think the lasting legacy is going to be of Florida's collegiate football heritage? I mean, could you even call it a heritage football here in Florida? Is it as ingrained to Florida culture as the beaches here?
Oh, definitely. I mean, just look at the data, the sheer number of participants, the money, the complaints by faculty about the money going in the wrong places. I mean, good luck trying to cut back.
That was Gary Mormino on his story, Gridiron Glory. A special thank you to Bill Maxwell for lending his voice and speaking with me about his excerpt in the article. Forum Beyond the Pages is produced by Florida Humanities. Our music was created by Tampa Bay area musician JJ Padishaw. You can follow him on Instagram at JJ Padishaw Music. Want to get the latest issue of Forum delivered to your door 3 times a year? Become a Florida Humanities member by visiting floridahumanities.org/membership. Until next time.